From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Police in Manchester, England have identified the suicide bomber they say carried out last night's attacks as 22-year-old Salman Abedi. He died and at least 22 other people were killed in the attack outside the Ariana Grande concert at Manchester Arena. More than 50 people were hurt. Many of the victims, fans of the 23-year-old Grande, were children, including an 8-year-old, Safi Rose Roussos. Here's British Prime Minister Theresa May.
All acts of terrorism are cowardly attacks on innocent people. But this attack stands out for its appalling, sickening cowardice, deliberately targeting innocent, defenseless children and young people who should have been enjoying one of the most memorable nights of their lives.
NPR's Frank Langford is in Manchester. Frank, what do we know about the alleged bomber?
Well, we know, Robin, that he was 22 years old and that he was on the radar of intelligence agencies here in Britain. A high-ranking Western government official told me that they believe that he may have recently returned from Libya. Police are now kind of trying to determine, they say, if this is part of a radical Islamist network here in the United Kingdom. But analysts I talked to say that they're pretty sure that this fellow was. And what they're hearing from intelligence here is that he was someone that was peripheral, someone that, that intelligence agencies were had an eye on, but did not see him as high risk.
Do we know anything about the actual bomb? Eyewitnesses last night said they saw bolts, across the floor.
Well, we don't. I know those details we haven't gotten from the police yet to find out exactly what was inside the bomb. But some sources that I were talking to described it as powerful and effective. And one of the concerns as this is this man actually would not have had the capability to actually build this. Here was the quote that I got. Our assessment is he did not have the skills to build such a bomb, and the conclusion is there is a bomb maker out there. And so the concern is that there could be somebody else with these skills who could be looking to do this again. Now, earlier today, there was a 23-year-old who was arrested by police. We don't know exactly why he was arrested. Perhaps it seems like they would be certainly looking if this fella who died, the suicide bomber, didn't have the skills. Certainly they would be looking for somebody who did.
Yeah, that was a big question after the Boston bombing, too, and they never really traced that. There were thousands of children, teenagers, parents at the show. Here's one of the teens, Kennedy Hill. She was there with her mom and spoke to the BBC.
All of a sudden, there was a loud bang, and it sounded like an echo, but it sounded like balloons had been popped, like they'd been stood on or something like that. And, I mean, we looked at each other like, oh, my God.
Frank Langford, do we have any sense why the bomber targeted this event, this venue?
We don't. Now, it's very interesting. Here in the United Kingdom, there is a long history of terrorism. Certainly, you remember back in the 70s, the Irish Republican Army. But nothing quite like this. Usually what we see is indiscriminate attacks on people, ordinary folks. This was one where clearly the people who were targeted were young people who went to the concert and their families. Now, I talked to analysts today to try to make sense of this. And one person I said, said to me, shock value, of course, inflict pain on the West based on, sort of the coalition bombings that we've seen in Syria and Libya and basically payback. But another analyst I was talking to thought that we shouldn't focus so much on the youth and that this could be a matter of Islamist distaste for music and Western youth culture and that it was really more driven by those concerns and that, anger towards that kind of culture that many Islamists obviously don't like much.
Well, it also could be because he could. It reminds us of the Brussels train station bombing. The security perimeter doesn't matter if you can be standing right outside that security perimeter as people flow out of, say, an arena, when you're checked and you go in.
A very soft target. And the bomb, as we understand it, was not inside. If you saw the video, it was not inside the venue, not inside the stadium, arena itself. And so a soft target and not probably a hard thing to do if you had the right skills, you had someone helping you.
Yeah, it just raises so many questions. How far can you move the security perimeter out if it's a public place outside the arena and there's shops and things and ticket counters as this place and many, many venues have, around the world? Look, Frank, what's going on there today in Manchester? I'm sure somber, but we know that Manchester has a lot of those closed-circuit televisions that you see in London. We know M5 and special branch authorities are going through a lot of that CCTV footage and asking people to upload their videos onto police websites as part of this intelligence. What's the mood there?
Well, I think it is very somber, of course. One of the things that you saw last night, though, that I think people here in Manchester are very proud of is that taxi drivers offered free rides to people away from the venue. Mm-hmm. People were offered to come into people's homes, people who'd been stranded because the train station was shut down. And so there is a sense of toughness here and a sense of community and a sense that they're not going to be cowed by this.
Yeah, we understand there's actually concerts going on tonight. NPR's Frank Langfitt, they're in Manchester, England. Frank, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Robin.
Well, President Trump has arrived in Rome after his trip to Israel and the West Bank. He met with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in Bethlehem. There he praised Abbas and advocated peace between Israelis and Palestinians. He also had this to say about yesterday's attack in Manchester.
The terrorists and extremists and those who give them aid and comfort must be driven out from our society forever. This wicked ideology must be obliterated, and I mean completely obliterated, and the innocent life must be protected.
Well, joining us for more is NPR's Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem. Daniel, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called Trump's visit a historic visit. What made it historic?
It was the first time a U.S. president has visited Israel on his first trip abroad. It was also the first time a sitting U.S. president has visited the Western Wall, which is the top Jewish prayer site in Jerusalem. It's a remnant of the Jewish temple complex from 2,000 years ago. And then Trump also visited the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where Christian tradition says Jesus was crucified and resurrected. And he did some other things like laying a wreath at Israel's Holocaust Memorial. He gave a speech at Israel's leading museum. And he also visited with Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas in Bethlehem in the West Bank.
Yeah, he visited with Abbas. Did Netanyahu respond to that?
Yes. Well, Netanyahu spoke shortly before Trump spoke in his final farewell address. And Netanyahu took a jab at Abbas. He said if the Manchester bomber had been Palestinian, that Abbas and his government would have given financial support to that attacker. And it's a policy that the Palestinian government pays Palestinian attackers and their families, people who carry out attacks on Israelis. Palestinians see it as a kind of welfare payments to people who support the Palestinian cause. Trump simply replied in his speech that Abbas is ready to work toward peace.
So when it comes to a peace and a possible peace deal, Trump has said he wants to make that deal. Here he is in his meeting with Abbas.
I am truly hopeful that America can help Israel and the Palestinians forge peace and bring new hope to the region and its people. I also firmly believe that if Israel and the Palestinians can make peace, it will begin a process of peace all throughout the Middle East, and that would be an amazing accomplishment.
Do Israelis and Palestinians believe that Trump can do that after his visit?
It's a great question. I think cynicism is really high here, as you can imagine, especially after many U.S. presidents have tried and failed with their peace efforts. They've come here, they've visited, they've left, and the situation remains the same, and some people say worse. Some Israelis and Palestinians I've spoken to said they don't think Trump will be any different than previous U.S. presidents, but some do see him as very different. Some Israelis see him as more friendly toward Israel. And even some Palestinians think his businessman's approach to getting a deal done might be what is needed to actually see peace here.
So, Daniel, overall, when you look at this trip, and there were a couple of slip-ups that made the news. There was Trump yesterday saying that he never said Israel in the Oval Office when he revealed some classified information to the Russians. That wasn't something that anyone had accused him of actually saying, but he said that right next to Netanyahu. As you look at the trip overall, was it a success? What was accomplished?
Well, Trump didn't come here with any peace initiative. It was mostly about Trump trying to strengthen his relationships with both sides, with Israel and the Palestinians, highlighting how he's different than his predecessor, Obama. Obama skipped Israel on his first Mideast trip, and Israel never forgot that, and that was very clear on this visit. But, you didn't hear Trump talk about settlements, Israeli settlements in the West Bank, where Palestinians want to create a state. You didn't hear him speak about other things like the two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So very short on specifics, but mostly to strengthen his relationship with Israel and the Palestinians. And the Israelis and the Palestinians wanted to strengthen their relationship with Trump, too.
That's NPR's Jerusalem correspondent Daniel Estrin as President Trump heads to his next stop on his trip. That would be Italy. Daniel, thank you.
You're welcome.
And now to President Trump's former security adviser, Michael Flynn. Yesterday, Elijah Cummings, the leading Democrat on the House Oversight Committee, said his panel has documents showing that Flynn appeared to lie to investigators during his security clearance renewal last spring in the Obama administration. He said Flynn told the investigators that U.S. companies paid for his visit to a gala dinner in Russia. In fact, the Russian propaganda outlet RT did, paying him $45,000. Yesterday, Flynn also informed the Senate Intelligence Committee investigating ties to Russia that he would invoke his Fifth Amendment right to not incriminate himself by not testifying or responding to subpoenas for documents. Then there was that deep dive last week from the McClatchy newspapers about Flynn's payments from Turkey as he was representing U.S. interests. It has some congressmen raising the word treason. Vera Bergengruen reported that story. She joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What happened? This was 10 days before Donald Trump was sworn in as president, but Michael Flynn had already been picked by him to be the security advisor, and he was meeting with President Obama's security advisor, Susan Rice.
That's correct. The Obama administration was making its final big national security decision, wanting to pull the trigger on a plan to arm Syrian Kurds to retake this Islamic State capital of Raqqa.
Something the Pentagon had spent 7 months developing, but I guess the Obama administration realized it would actually be carried out during the Trump administration.
Correct. And they didn't want to start something that was just going to be reversed. So they decided they were going to allow the Trump administration to make the decision. And the person who made that decision on behalf of the Trump administration was Michael Flynn as national security advisor. And he told them, don't go ahead with it. He halted it. And he said, we will make the decision when we are after the inauguration.
So, of course, we now know at that time, Michael Flynn was being paid by the Turkish government. Flesh that out more.
In early March, we found out that Flynn had been paid to represent Turkish interests. He was paid more than $500,000. And we found out because he himself registered as a foreign agent with the Justice Department, which all U.S. citizens have to do, supposedly 10 days after they first start representing another country's interests.
Well, of course, for him, this was very late.
Exactly. But usually the Justice Department doesn't really prosecute these cases. They just kind of tell people to comply and then all's good. So Flynn and his associates said that they had registered out of an abundance of caution, but he was hired by a Turkish businessman to represent Turkish interests from August to November. And during that time, he was sitting in classified briefings. He was in every major meeting that Donald Trump had about national security because he was Donald Trump's top foreign policy advisor.
Well, and so now the criticism is that in that meeting with Susan Rice, when he said, no, don't go ahead with this 7-month Pentagon plan to retake the Syrian city of Raqqa with Kurdish forces, when he said no to that, that he was actually, you know, instead of siding with U.S. interests, he was siding with Turkish interests. Remind us why there's that criticism.
So Turkey has very long opposed any partnership with the Syrian Kurdish forces known as the YPG. They see them as terrorists because they are linked to the PKK, which is a terrorist organization. And they have long opposed the U.S. partnering with these forces. But the Pentagon thinks that they are the most effective force to retake this ISIS capital of Raqqa. And Turkey wants the U.S. to use Turkish forces and their local partners. But these forces have never really materialized. The Pentagon calls them Erdogan's ghost army. They think that they're not effective in doing this. And so it's been a very delicate balancing act for the U.S. for a long time to say that they support Turkey as a key ally, as a NATO member, as, you know, somebody who's fighting the Islamic State with them and also supporting this group that Turkey says is carrying out terrorist attacks against them.
Yeah. Well, and it could just be that as opposed to the Obama administration and the Pentagon, General Michael Flynn personally did not think it was a good idea to work with Kurdish forces. But what are you hearing from members of Congress who now read that Michael Flynn was being paid by the Turkish government when he told the U.S. government to stop an offensive?
That's correct. I mean, it could have been a number of reasons. Back when this was reported by the Washington Post in February that Flynn had decided to halt this plan, his staff, you know, was quoted as saying that this was shoddy staff work, that it had gaps in it, that didn't think it was a good plan. Of course, now Donald Trump has gone ahead with the very same plan 3 months after it was halted by Flynn. But members of Congress are saying, as they are investigating Flynn's connections to foreign governments, while the Russian investigations have held most of the spotlight, and it is well known that Flynn received money to speak at a gala with Putin and that he had some contacts with the Russian government, this is an actual paper trail that Flynn himself filed the paperwork for. So members of Congress are saying there's a lot on the Russia front, but we actually have paperwork here saying that he was working secretly as a foreign agent for Turkish interests. He didn't disclose it until after. And he may have been making all of these decisions after being paid $500,000 by Turkey. Members of Congress are saying that this is, in many ways, the clearest example and connection to Flynn actually representing foreign interests and not having disclosed them.
Look, another of Turkey's big goals was to extradite Fethullah Gulen, that's the Turkish cleric who's living in Pennsylvania in self-imposed exile, who the Turkish president, Erdogan, blames for that failed coup attempt last July. What's alleged that Michael Flynn did to try to help Turkey with that?
So that has been one of Turkey's major goals. It was the Syria decision and the Gulen decision. Those were the two things that Turkey really wanted from the U.S. They were very frustrated with the Obama administration. I was in Turkey in March, and every single Turkish official would speak extensively about how frustrated they were that the Obama administration did not take their concerns about Gulen seriously. They say he leads a terrorist organization and that his followers tried to overthrow Erdogan last summer. And supposedly, Flynn was really just hired to do research into different ways that they could make the U.S. cooperate and extradite Gulen. But of course, this would have to be handled by the Justice Department. The Justice Minister of Turkey talked to Jeff Sessions. They had all of these different meetings, but they can't really do anything about it. They say if the court doesn't think there's sufficient evidence, we're not going to extradite him. So Flynn apparently set up a couple of meetings between Homeland Security officials, between some lawmakers and Turkish officials so they could make this case. So in one of the stranger cases, the former Central Intelligence Agency director James Woolsey said he was part of a conversation where Flynn and Turkish officials were meeting in a hotel room in New York secretly, and they were trying to come up with ways that they could extradite Gulen without actually going through the process. So basically, he said something about whisking him away in the middle of the night and that in all these different ways they were trying to get him. The Turkish government really, really wants to get this guy back.
Well, here's Michael Flynn, who was briefly the national security advisor, weighing in on this and hearing intelligence in the Trump administration. But even before that, writing an opinion piece on Election Day titled "Our Ally Turkey is in Crisis, Needs Our Support," as you write, slamming the Obama administration for not taking Turkey's concerns about the cleric Gulen seriously and describing him as a shady Islamic mullah, comparing him to Osama bin Laden, all while being paid by a foreign government.
This editorial that Flynn wrote for the Hill newspaper on Election Day was what raised all these flags for the Justice Department, because it seemed to come out of the blue that he would be advocating these very kind of niche Turkish policy goals, which before he didn't seem to be standing for, when during the coup over the summer, he seemed to be holding the opposite position about the coup. And suddenly he was calling it out. He was saying that Gulen should be extradited. And this seemed to, it was not disclosed in the editorial that he was being paid by Turkey. Mm-hmm. And he admitted in this paperwork that he filed with the Justice Department that he had sent it to this Turkish businessman who had hired him, who has ties to the Turkish government, to look it over, to approve this draft. And so that's what first raised flags, and that's when he first came under investigation for the Justice Department, who said he hasn't really filed any paperwork that he's working as a foreign agent.
No. Well, look, I can hear listeners saying, well, why isn't any of this treasonous, supporting another country instead of supporting the U.S. government? And you remind us, treason is the only crime defined in the Constitution, but it's described as levying war against the U.S. or adhering to an enemy. Turkey is not an enemy. There's no war involved here. So you say some Democrats are dusting off some other laws, like a 1799 statute that bars private citizens from interfering with diplomatic relations.
They are, and they use treason kind of loosely because in their minds, Flynn made a national security decision that may have harmed U.S. interests, and he was acting on behalf of a foreign government.
Well, stopping an attack on ISIS, on Raqqa, by the Kurds.
Right, and they're saying, how is this not treasonous? Well, actually, you can only be convicted of treason if the U.S. is at war with that country, and even though the Islamic State would qualify for that, it's very murky. Mm-hmm. And the example that treason experts gave me was that in the 1950s, even when people were giving over nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union, they were tried and executed for espionage, not for treason. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what some members of Congress are now looking into. And they're looking into some other more obscure laws, including one that says that former military officers have to get congressional approval before they're allowed to be paid by a foreign government. The Pentagon says he never did that before he was paid to give a speech in Russia. Mm. But Democrats in Congress are still trying to figure out how exactly to connect the dots and make show that what he did was illegal.
That's Vera Bergengruen, national correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Vera, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started. Started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Do you think you're one of them? Time to wake up.
Recognize that sound? That is from Avatar. It has been 8 years since that James Cameron movie was released. And this Saturday, Disney opens the Pandora World of Avatar theme park. It's an extension of Disney's Animal Kingdom in Florida and is the biggest U.S. expansion of a Disney park in more than 10 years. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us now with more on this. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
And this is a $500 million park. Tell us more about it. What is Disney trying to do here?
Well, a little backdrop to this is that Disney's Parks and Resorts division posted record profits recently. Attendance at domestic parks has been growing substantially. So this 12-acre Avatar attraction really marks an effort for them to increase capacity and guest spending. They just needed to grow. They needed to have new attractions. Among the attractions they'll have there, like a flight simulator, a river journey, and also a huge mountain that appears to float in the air. So they've sunk. Oh, yeah. So they got a lot for their $500 million, apparently.
And Avatar is one of the most successful movies of all time. It grossed nearly $3 billion, but that was nearly 10 years ago. I wonder if a lot of the young people who might go to the theme parks even ever saw the movie Avatar.
Or will they care? I mean, I think that's part of what Disney's banking on. Disney executives are saying that the quality of the park's attractions are what's going to draw people to Pandora, regardless of whether they're interested in the film. That said, this attraction lacks the marketable characters of Disney blockbusters like Frozen. Also, at the time of the deal, they made a deal with the director, James Cameron. My colleague Ben Fritz reported that this was driven partly in frustration that Disney had let the rights to Harry Potter go to Universal Studios. Mm. At the time of this deal, they thought there's going to be a sequel coming out, but that's not coming until 2020. They were hoping that they were going to time the sequel to the opening of the park. That didn't pan out.
Well, we mentioned that this is the biggest U.S. expansion of a Disney park in more than 10 years. But if you look at what's happening in Asia, Disney opened a park in Shanghai last year. Universal Studios Beijing is in the works, expected to open in 2020. There's also 20th Century Fox World, which is opening next year in Malaysia. What's the competition like among the theme park owners in Asia right now?
it's intense. It's intense. And also the number of people who are going is increasing dramatically. And that's why they're investing so much money. Disney's going to have a Toy Story themed land in Shanghai Disneyland, Marvel and Frozen lands at Hong Kong Disneyland. I didn't realize there were this many Disneylands. They're going to have Finding Nemo and Beauty and the Beast and Big Hero 6 in Tokyo. So they're spending big bucks because the audiences are really just growing substantially. If you look at the charts, since really 2008, it's been double-digit increases in the number of attendees.
And theme parks still a big part of Disney's empire?
Oh, yes. Very big part of it, especially right now while they're dealing with major subscriber losses at ESPN, another property of Disney. For some perspective, Disney's film studio, last quarter, they had an operating income of $656 million, whereas Disney's Parks and Resorts saw operating income of $750 million. That's an increase of 20%.
That's Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. Jason, thank you.
Thank you.
Republicans in the Senate continue to work on their version of a bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act after House Republicans passed their version earlier this month. And one of the businesses watching closely is CVS Health, a Fortune 500 company headquartered in Rhode Island. Joining us for today's View from the Top, our series of conversations with leaders, is CVS Health CEO Larry Merlo. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And I want to start with the issue of healthcare and how the healthcare policy in this country could change. CVS as a company took steps to support the implementation of Obamacare several years back. Obviously, CVS and other pharmacies stand to gain from the law because more people being insured means more people getting prescriptions and maybe picking up some other items while they're in the store. How effective do you think that Obamacare has been?
Well, Jeremy, I think the Affordable Care Act, certainly dealt with making healthcare more accessible. I think if you look at the uninsured rate, it's probably at its lowest level on record at between 8% and 9%. And from a business point of view, the Affordable Care Act did have a modest benefit to our performance through the expansion of Medicaid. At the same time, there's much more that needs to be done to make healthcare more affordable and more effective.
Do you believe that Obamacare is collapsing, as some Republicans have claimed?
Well, Jeremy, I think there's certainly a lot going on, and I think the future direction, of healthcare reform at this point is squarely in the hands of the Senate. A question that I get is, what would we like to see? And I think it goes back to seeing a bill that provides access to affordable healthcare for all Americans, and at the same time, one that allows the private sector to do what it does best, and that is to allow for market competition and innovation.
So when you say affordable access to all Americans, I assume then you mean that the American Healthcare Act that the Republicans have proposed is not something that you'd like, because as we've heard from the Congressional Budget Office, more than 20 million Americans would lose health coverage if that passes.
Well, Jeremy, I think if you look at healthcare, some of the facts that continue to be true today, healthcare spending is increasing too fast. Nearly, one out of every $5 in the country goes towards healthcare. So clearly there are things that, aren't working in our delivery system. We think about three variables that contribute to healthcare spending, those being quality, access, and cost.
But do you favor the Republican plan on healthcare?
I think there are elements that make sense from the Republican plan, but, clearly there are other elements that, the Republican plan does not deal with. I think that there are, many open questions that, have yet to be answered.
What is it like to be running a major business in this country right now with the kind of political uncertainty that we're facing? Is that causing a problem for you?
We follow the news carefully, just like you and your listeners. And, there are, many things that, we've heard from President Trump in terms of outlining his agenda. There are things that, we're certainly very much aligned with. The need to overhaul our tax code and have a competitive tax rate is, of particular interest to us, in addition to some of the healthcare elements that we were talking about earlier. And, the opportunity to bring back, jobs to our country. That said, we don't have direct control, over that process. And our focus continues to be on putting our patients first and providing them with convenient access to affordable quality care.
Well, do you think that a tax overhaul is still likely? We saw the markets recently drop because of fear that all of this Comey, FBI, Russia investigation stuff is going to sideline some of the president's agenda.
It's certainly hard to answer that question. I don't think I'm in the best position to answer that, as I certainly don't have control over that process. It remains to be seen as to the pathway of getting those things done. You talk about tax. We were pleased to see the president's proposal to decrease the corporate tax rate to 15%. You know, we have worked for several years now in terms of educating policymakers on this particular topic. Today, our tax rate, when you look at federal and state combined, is more than 39%. So, you know, we pay about 1% of all corporate taxes in America, placing us at the very high end of corporate taxpayers. A meaningful reduction in the corporate tax rate would allow CVS Health to invest in growth and innovation, and we think that would be good for our customers, our patients, and good for the economy.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Larry Merlo, who is the CEO of CVS Health. And the company rebranded and became CVS Health in 2014. That was a move that made a lot of headlines because you decided to stop selling cigarettes. How much money did you lose because of that decision, and has it been worth it?
Well, Jeremy, it's a decision that, as we look at nearly 3 years later now, we're very pleased that we made that decision, which was a tough one at the time. You know, we sold about $2 billion worth of tobacco and related items, and as we were growing as a company and more of a healthcare company, we saw the contradiction between, you know, delivering healthcare in the back of the store at the pharmacy and at the same time, you know, selling tobacco products that, you know, is a leading cause of death in this country.
Has it hurt?
You know, Jeremy, there was a short-term headwind as a result of that, but as we moved forward, you know, the opportunity to open up new partnerships with whether it's a health plan, a hospital system, a health system, we have certainly been able to grow our business in other areas that has more than made up, you know, for the loss of selling tobacco products.
Are you seeing any trouble right now as some other retailers are? Some of the big retailers in this country are starting to see some signs of trouble.
Well, Jeremy, if you're referring to, are we seeing the impact that online stores, you know, are having in the business? Obviously, they're growing as a percentage of the overall retail market. I would say at this point, their share remains relatively small, especially, you know, within our channel. And we've got 9,700 pharmacies across the country. More than 75% of the population lives within a few miles of a CVS. And I think customers value the convenience that, you know, that we offer.
Do you expect Amazon to get into the pharmacy market?
You know, Amazon, it certainly is a well-respected competitor, and, you know, we would never take their actions lightly. I do believe it's important to acknowledge that pharmacy is very different from selling other products to consumers. Pharmacy is highly regulated. The barrier to entry is high. Today, less than 15% of all prescriptions are dispensed through mail order pharmacies, and that number has actually been on the decline.
CVS Health, along with some other companies, was named in a lawsuit from the Cherokee Nation saying it wasn't doing enough to stop prescription opioids from flooding into their communities. How do you respond to that, that maybe CVS Health and Walmart in this case and other companies should have been doing more to stop what is becoming such an enormous opioid crisis in this country?
Well, Jeremy, that is certainly an area of great concern for us, and it's an epidemic that does not discriminate. It exists in our cities and the suburbs and across rural America, and, you know, there's no single cause to the problem, and, you know, the solution is going to require a multi-pronged effort involving, you know, many of the healthcare players, whether it's pharmacy or physicians, the pharmaceutical industry, insurers, certainly the government. We have been doing many things in this area. The first being prevention through education. Our pharmacists are going out into the community at junior, senior high schools, educating students on the dangers of prescription drug abuse. Today, we've touched over 250,000 students all across the country. The second focus is on collection. You know, what we can do in terms of emptying medicine cabinets in homes of unused prescription medications. And working with community leaders and law enforcement, we've been able to remove over 80 metric tons of unused medications in an environmentally safe manner. And then the third is we've been working to partner with states to ensure appropriate access to the opioid overdose reversal medication, naloxone.
Do you think, though, that it is the responsibility of your employees to make sure, for example, that if multiple people from the same house are coming in to collect prescriptions, that they have to ask many questions about that before they give them out? Or is that even possible for all of your employees to be so careful about handing out prescriptions?
Well, Jeremy, we have worked, you know, with our pharmacists to provide them the tools, largely through technology, to ensure that, you know, the right patients are receiving, you know, the appropriate medications and therapies. You know, one of the things that we would advocate for that, you know, is you look at a first-time user of a pain medication. It could be as a result of an ankle sprain, perhaps, you know, some type of, you know, oral surgery. And oftentimes you see prescriptions being written for 30, 60 tablets. And, you know, we would advocate for regulation that, you know, if it's a first-time user, you know, they have perhaps a three to five day supply so that, you know, those prescriptions do not find their way into, you know, unsafe hands. And that's something that we'll continue to talk about with the regulators.
That's Larry Merlo, who is the CEO of CVS Health. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
ISIS has claimed responsibility for last night's attack that killed at least 22 people and injured dozens more at a huge concert in Manchester, England. ISIS making the claim through one of its official news outlets and calling the attacker a soldier of the caliphate. Of course, we don't know if ISIS even had contact with the attacker. But recently, as the border with Syria has tightened, ISIS has told followers to stay home and attack where you are with cars, bombs, knives. So what is the status of ISIS? Seth Jones is director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND. And Seth, we're reading of ISIS recruiters on the internet talking directly to attackers, even sometimes right up to an attack. You know, we sometimes think of attackers as lone wolves, but how many are directly guided by ISIS recruiters?
Well, ISIS has a number of approaches that they are implementing right now. They certainly are reaching out to individuals to encourage them to conduct attacks. And in that case, what we've seen is instances where individuals have been communicating with them directly through encrypted apps, including WhatsApp, and other forums, including jihadist websites. So directly communicating them with them. But we're also seeing a range of other more informal encouragement to incite attacks. So no direct communication, but comments from ISIS leaders, including Baghdadi, to encourage people in their home countries across the West, for example, to conduct these kinds of very simple attacks.
Well, and the U.S. with drone strikes has been able to reach into some of these, you know, so-called ISIS cyber planners. Amriki was a famous one who was killed in a drone strike, but he was directly communicating with, you know, a young man in Virginia. I mean, they are directly communicating through the internet and these encrypted sites.
There's no question that ISIS individuals and actually Al-Qaeda as well are directly communicating with individuals in the West, including in the United States, as well as in the UK and across Europe, to incite them to conduct attacks in their areas. And as the so-called caliphate in Iraq and Syria for ISIS continues to lose territory, the group has increasingly reached out to individuals not to come to Iraq and Syria, but to conduct those attacks in their own countries. It's just easier logistically to do it that way.
Now, last week, Defense Secretary James Mattis said that the U.S. was pursuing an accelerated operation against ISIS to end the phony caliphate, and that there actually was success even prior to that in the Obama administration in tightening the borders, shutting down the border crossings, people traveling to Syria to train. But it sounds like what you're saying is it's the old phrase whack-a-mole, that it's moved onto the internet or maybe into other countries. What other countries are you worried about that may be taking up where Syria and Iraq are letting off?
Well, what's actually pretty stunning across the board is how much territory ISIS has actually lost. They have controlled bits and pieces of territory, not just in Iraq and Syria, but also in Egypt, in Libya, in Afghanistan, and in Nigeria under Boko Haram. They have cell structures in a much larger area. And U.S. and other efforts have actually significantly curbed their control of territory. But there are active jihadist battlefields in several of them. One of the more concerning ones is Libya right now. Outside of Iraq and Syria, they're probably more violent extremists there than almost anywhere else right now. And it's very close to Europe, just across the Mediterranean. So Libya is certainly has blinking red right now in its threat.
And it feels as if we've seen an increase in these ISIS-inspired attacks. You mentioned the bridge, the arena. Is that because they've been so successful in recruiting, or are we seeing sort of last gasps? I mean, how would you characterize where we are right now?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons why we're seeing an increase in ISIS violence and a growth in areas across the world where they're conducting attacks. Again, they're losing territory. That data is pretty significant. I've looked at the declines and calculated the percentages across the countries where ISIS has lost territory. Part of this may be the resources they've had to spend to control areas in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan and Libya and Nigeria and other countries. The resources, when they control territory, are generally devoted towards state building. And when they lose that territory, they are, in a sense, freeing up those resources for other purposes, including external operations. So part of this may also be those resources that they once devoted to controlling territory, they're now using for encouraging people to fight overseas.
That may be
part of the explanation.
Well, others have said that their economic model is changing, but they've pointed to another aspect, that they're losing and losing territory. They're losing, for instance, things like high revenue producing oil wells. And that's where they'd gotten their money. So perhaps also they don't have as much money.
Well, the issue is to conduct terrorist attacks, including the one that we've seen recently in Manchester, it doesn't require much money, especially if you're simply inspiring people. That doesn't cost a lot. It does cost a lot to run an area. So it's moving from an insurgent group that controls territory to a global terrorist organization that is conducting attacks, and it's much cheaper to conduct terrorist attacks than it is to run an area.
Right, to run a city. Seth Jones, director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND, with a look at ISIS the day after an attack the group is claiming. Seth, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.